In here. Go to the booths at the back and sit down. I made a single sweep of the street, saw no one obvious, and followed Sullivan inside. The place was almost empty. The daytime diners long departed, and the evening not yet cranked up. Two ancient Chinese women sat in a corner with the withered elegance of dried bouquets, heads nodding together. On the other side of the restaurant, four young men in pale silk suits lounged dangerously and toyed with expensive-looking chunks of hardware. At a table near one of the windows, a fat Caucasian was working his way through an enormous bowl of chow mein and simultaneously flicking over the pages of a holoporn comic. A video screen set high on one wall gave out coverage of some incomprehensible local sport. "Tea," I said to the young waiter who came to meet us, and seated myself opposite Sullivan in the booth.
"You aren't going to get away with this," he said unconvincingly. "Even if you kill me, really kill me, they'll check the most recent resleevings and backtrack to you sooner or later."
"Yeah, maybe they'll even find out about the unofficial surgery the sleeve had before I arrived."
"That bitch! She's going to—"
"You're in no position to be making threats," I said mildly. "In fact, you're in no position to do anything except answer my questions and hope I believe you. Who told you to tag me?" Silence, apart from the game coverage from the set on the wall. Sullivan stared sullenly at me. "All right, I'll make it easy for you. Simple yes or no. An artificial called Trep came to see you. Was this the first time you'd had dealings with her?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
With measured anger, I backhanded him hard across the mouth. He collapsed sideways against the wall of the booth, losing his hat. The conversation of the young men in silk stopped abruptly, then resumed with great animation as I cut them a sideways glance. The two old women got stiffly to their feet and filed out through a back entrance. The Caucasian didn't even look up from his holoporn. I leaned across the table. "Warden Sullivan, you're not taking this in the spirit it's intended. I am very concerned to know who you sold me to. I'm not going to go away just because you have some residual scruples about client confidentiality. Believe me, they didn't pay you enough to hold out on me." Sullivan sat back up, wiping at the blood trickling from the corner of his mouth. To his credit, he managed a bitter smile with the undamaged portion of his lips.
"You think I haven't been threatened before, Kovacs?"
I examined the hand I'd hit him with. "I think you've had very little experience of personal violence, and that's going to be a disadvantage. I'm going to give you the chance to tell me what I want to know here and now. After that, we go somewhere with soundproofing. Now, who sent Trep?"
"You're a thug, Kovacs. Nothing but—"
I snapped folded knuckles across the table and into his left eye. It made less noise than the slap. Sullivan grunted in shock and reeled away from the blow, cowering into the seat. I watched him passively until he recovered. Something cold was rising in me, something born on the benches of the New Pest Justice Facility, and tempered with the years of pointless unpleasantness I had been witness to. I hoped Sullivan wasn't as tough as he was trying to appear, for both our sakes. I leaned close again. "You said it, Sullivan. I'm a thug, not a respectable criminal like you. I'm not a meth, not a businessman. I have no vested interests, no social connections, no purchased respectability. It's just me, and you're in my way. So, let's start again. Who sent Trep?"
"He doesn't know, Kovacs. You're wasting your time."
The woman's voice was light and cheerful, pitched a little loud to carry from the door where she stood, hands in the pockets of a long black coat. She was slim and pale, with close-cropped dark hair and a poise to the way she stood that bespoke combat skills. Beneath the coat she wore a gray quilted tunic that looked impact-resistant, and matching work trousers tucked into ankle boots. A single silver earring in the shape of a discarded trode cable dangled from her left ear. She appeared to be alone. I lowered the Phillips gun slowly, and without acknowledging that it had ever been trained on her, she took the cue to advance casually into the restaurant. The young men in silk watched her every step of the way, but if she was aware of their gazes, she gave no sign. When she was about 5 paces from our booth, she gave me a look of inquiry and began to lift her hands slowly out of her pockets. I nodded, and she completed the movement, revealing open palms and fingers set with rings of black glass.
Trep?
Good guess. You going to let me sit down?
I waved the Phillips gun at the seat opposite, where Sullivan was cupping both hands to his eye.
If you can persuade your associate here to move over, just keep your hands above the table.
The woman smiled and inclined her head. She glanced at Sullivan, who was already squeezing up to the wall to make space for her, and then, keeping her hands poised at her sides, she swung herself elegantly in beside him. The economy of motion was so tight that her pendant earring barely shifted. Once seated, she pressed both hands palm down on the table in front of her.
"That make you feel safer?"
"It'll do," I said, noticing that the black glass rings, like the earring, were a body joke. Each ring showed, X-ray-like, a ghostly blue section of the bones and the fingers beneath. Trep's style, at least, I could get to like.
"I didn't tell him anything,"
Sullivan blurted.
"You don't know anything worth a jack,"
Trep said disinterestedly. She hadn't even turned to look at him.
"Lucky for you I turned up, I'd say. Mr. Kovach doesn't look like someone ready to take 'don't know' for an answer. Am I right?"
"What do you want, Trep?"
"Come to help out."
Trep glanced up as something rattled in the restaurant. The waiter had arrived, bearing a tray with a large teapot and two handleless cups.
"You order this?"
"Yeah. Help yourself."
"Thanks. I love this stuff."
Trep waited while the waiter deposited everything, then busied herself with the teapot.
"Sullivan, you want a cup, too? Hey, bring him another cup, would you? Thanks. Now, where was I?"
"You'd come to help out," I said pointedly.
"Yeah."
Trep sipped to the green tea and looked at me over the rim of the cup.
"That's right. I'm here to clarify things. See, you're trying to hammer the information out of Sullivan here, and he doesn't know fuck all. His contact was me, so here I am. Talk to me."
I looked at her levelly.
"I killed you last week, Trep."
"Yeah, so they tell me."
Trep set down the teacup and looked critically at her own finger bones.
"Course, I don't remember that. In fact, I don't even know you, Kovach. Last thing I remember was putting myself into the tank about a month back. Everything after that's gone. The me you torched in that cruiser, she's dead. That wasn't me. So, no hard feelings, huh?"
"No remote storage, Trep?" She snorted.
"Are you kidding? I make a living doing this, same as you, but not that much. Anyway, who needs that remote shit? The way I figure it, you fuck up, you've got to pay some kind of tab for it. I fucked up with you, right?"
I sipped my own tea and played back the fight in the air car, considering the angles.
"You were a little slow," I conceded. "A little careless."
"Yeah, careless. I got to watch that. Wearing artificials makes you that way. Very anti-Zen. I got a sensei in New York. It drives him up the fucking wall."
"That's too bad," I said patiently. "You want to tell me who sent you now?"
"Hey, better than that. You're invited to meet the man."
She nodded at my expression.
"Yeah, Ray wants to talk to you. Same as last time, except this is a voluntary ride. Seems coercion doesn't work too well with you."
"And Cadman? He's in on this as well?"
Trep drew breath in through her teeth.
Cadman's a bit of a side issue right now. Bit of an embarrassment, really, but I think we can deal on that as well. I really can't tell you too much more now."
She shuttled her glance sideways at Sullivan, who was beginning to sit up and pay attention.
"It's better if we go someplace else."
"All right," I nodded. "I'll follow you out. But let's have a couple of ground rules before we go. One, no virtuals."
"Way ahead of you there."
Trep finished her tea and started to get up from the table.
"My instructions are to convey you directly to Ray, in the flesh."
I put a hand on her arm and she stopped moving abruptly.
"Two, no surprises. You tell me exactly what's going to happen well before it does. Anything unexpected? And you're likely to be disappointing your sensei all over again."
"Fine. No surprises."
Trep produced a slightly forced smile that told me she wasn't accustomed to being grabbed by the arm.
"We're going to walk out of the restaurant and catch a taxi. That all right by you?"
"Just so long as it's empty."
I released her arm and she resumed motion, coming fluidly upright, hands still well away from her sides. I reached into my pocket and tossed a couple of plastic notes at Sullivan. "You stay here. If I see your face come through the door before we're gone, I'll put a hole in it. Tease on me." As I followed Trepp to the door, the waiter arrived with Sullivan's teacup and a big white handkerchief, presumably for the warden's smashed lip. Nice kid. He practically tripped over himself trying to stay out of my way, and the look he gave me was mingled disgust and awe. In the wake of the icy fury that had possessed me earlier, I sympathized more than he could have known. The young men in silk watched us go with a dead-eyed concentration of snakes. Outside it was still raining. I turned up my collar and watched as Trepp produced a transport pager and waved it casually back and forth above her head.
"Be a minute,"
she said, and gave me a curious sidelong glance.
"You know who that place belongs to?"
I guessed. She shook her head.
"Triad Noodle House. Hell of a place for an interrogation. Or do you just like living dangerously?"
I shrugged. "Where I come from, criminals stay out of other people's fights. They're a gutless lot, generally. Much more likely to get interference from a solid citizen."
"Not around here. Most solid citizens around here are a little too solid to get involved in a brawl on some stranger's behalf. The way they figure it, that's what the police are for. You're from Harlan's world, right?"
"That's right."
"Maybe it's that Quellis thing, then, you reckon?"
"Maybe." An auto cab came spiraling down through the rain in response to the pager. Trepp stood aside at the open hatch and made an irony of demonstrating the empty compartment within. I smiled thinly. "After you."
"Suit yourself."
She climbed aboard and moved over to let me in. I settled back on the seat opposite her and watched her hands. When she saw where I was looking, she grinned and spread her arms cruciform along the back of the seat. The hatch hinged down, shedding rain in sliding sheets.
"Welcome to Herbline Services," the cab said smoothly. "Please state your destination."
"Airport,"
Trepp said, lounging back in her seat and looking for my reaction.
"Private carrier's terminal."
The cab lifted. I looked past Trepp at the rain on the rear window. "Not a local trip, then," I said tonelessly. She brought her arms in again, hands held palm upward.
"Well, we figured you wouldn't go virtual, so now we have to do it the hard way. Suborbital. Take about 3 hours."
"Suborbital?" I drew a deep breath and touched the holstered Phillips gun lightly. "You know, I'm going to get really upset if someone asks me to check this hardware before we fly."
"Yeah, we figured that, too. Relax, Kovach. You heard me say private terminal. This is a custom flight, just for you. Carry a fucking tactical nuke on board if you like, okay?"
"Where are we going, Trepp?" She smiled.
"Europe,"
she said. Chapter 25. Wherever it was in Europe that we landed, the weather was better. We left the blunt, windowless suborbital sitting on the fused glass runway and walked to the terminal building through glinting sunlight that was a physical pressure on my body, even through my jacket. The sky above was an uncompromising blue from horizon to horizon, and the air felt hard and dry. According to the pilot's time check, it was still only mid-afternoon. I shrugged my way out of the jacket.
"Should be a limo waiting for us,"
Trepp said over her shoulder. We passed without formality into the terminal and across a zone of microclimate where palms and other less recognizable tropicalia made a bid for the massive glass ceiling. A misty rain drifted down from sprinkler systems, rendering the air pleasantly damp after the aridity outside. Along the aisles set between the trees, children played and squalled, and old people sat dozily on wrought-iron benches in a seemingly impossible coexistence. The middle generations were gathered in knots at coffee stands, talking with more gesticulation than I'd seen in Bay City, and seemingly oblivious to the factors of time and schedule that govern most terminal buildings. I adjusted the jacket across my shoulder to cover my weapons as much as possible, and followed Trepp into the trees. It wasn't quick enough to beat the gaze of two security guards standing under a palm nearby, or that of a little girl scuffing her toes along the side of the aisle toward us.
Trepp made a sign to the security as they stiffened, and they fell back into the previous relaxed postures with nods. Clearly, we were expected. The little girl wasn't so easily bought. She stared up at me with wide eyes until I made a pistol out of my fingers and shot her with noisy sound effects. Then she showed her teeth in a huge grin and hid behind the nearest bench. I heard her shooting me in the back all the way along the aisle. Outside again, Trepp steered me past a mob of taxis to where an anonymous black cruiser was idling in a no-waiting zone. We climbed into air-conditioned cool and pale gray autumn-old seating.
10 minutes, she promised as we rose into the air. What did you think of the microclimate?
Very nice.
Got them all over the airport. Weekends, people come out from the center to spend the day here. Weird, huh?
I grunted and watched the window as we banked over the world settlement patterns of a major city. Further out, a dusty-looking plane stretched to the horizon and the almost painful blue of the sky. To the left, I could make out the rise of mountains. Trepp seemed to pick up on my disinclination to talk, and she busied herself with a phone jack that she plugged in behind the ear with the ironic pendant. Another internal chip. Her eyes closed as she began the call, and I was left with a peculiar feeling of aloneness that you get when someone's using one of those things. Alone was fine with me. The truth was that I'd been a poor traveling companion for Trepp for most of the journey. In the cabin of the subship, I'd been steadfastly withdrawn, despite Trepp's obvious interest in my background. Finally, she gave up trying to extract anecdotes about Harlan's world and the Corps and tried instead to teach me a couple of card games she knew. Impelled by some ghost of cultural politeness, I reciprocated, but 2 isn't an ideal number for cards, and neither of our hearts were in it. We landed in Europe in silence, each flipping through our own selection from the jet's media stack. Despite Trepp's apparent lack of concern on the subject, I was having a hard time forgetting the circumstances of our last trip together. Below us, the plain gave way to increasingly green uplands, and then one valley in particular where the forested crags seemed to close around something man-made. As we started to descend, Trepp unjacked herself with a flutter of eyelids that meant she hadn't bothered to disconnect the chip synapses first, strictly advised against by most manufacturers. But maybe she was showing off. I barely noticed. Most of me was absorbed in the thing we were landing beside. It was a massive stone cross, larger than any I'd seen before and weather-stained with age. As the cruiser spiraled down toward its base and then beyond, I realized that whoever had built the monument had set it on a huge central buttress of rock, so it gave the impression of a titanic broadsword sunk into the earth by some retired warrior god. It was entirely in keeping with the dimensions of the mountains around it, as if no human agency could possibly have put it there. The step terraces of stone and ancillary buildings below the buttress, themselves monumental in size, shrank almost to insignificance under the brooding presence of this single artifact. Trepp was watching me with a glitter in her eyes. The limo settled on one of the stone expanses, and I climbed out, blinking up through the sun at the cross.
"This belonged to the Catholics?"
I hazarded.
"Used to."
Trepp started toward a set of towering steel doors in the rock ahead.
"Back when it was new. It's private property now."
"How come?"
"Ask Ray."
Now it was Trepp who seemed uninterested in conversation. It was almost as if something in the vast structure was calling a different part of her character into ascendancy. She drifted to the doors as if attracted there by magnetism. As we reached the portals, they yawned slowly open with a dull hum of powered hinges and stopped with an aperture of 2 meters between them. I gestured at Trepp, and she stepped over the threshold with a shrug. Something big moved spider-like down the walls in the dimness to either side of the entrance. I slipped a hand to the butt of the Nemex, knowing as I did that it was futile. We were in the land of the giants now. Skeletal gun barrels the length of a man's body emerged from the gloom as the 2 robot sentry systems sniffed us over. I judged the caliber about the same as the Hendrix's lobby defense system and relinquished the Nemex. With a vaguely insectile chittering, the automated killing units drew back and spidered back up the walls to their roosting points. At the base of the 2 alcoves they lived in, I could make out massive iron angels with swords.
Come on.
Trepp's voice was unnaturally loud in the cathedral hush.
You think we wanted to kill you, we would have brought you all the way here?
I followed her down a flight of stone steps and into the main body of the chamber. We were in a huge basilica that must run the length of the rock buttress beneath the cross, and whose ceiling was lost in gloom high above us. Up ahead was another set of steps, leading onto a raised and slightly narrower section where the lighting was stronger. As we reached it, I saw that the roof here was vaulted with the stone statues of hooded guardians, their hands resting on thick broadswords and their lips curled into faintly contemptuous smiles below their hoods. I felt my own lips twist in fractional response, and my thoughts were all of high-yield explosives. At the end of the basilica, gray things were hanging in the air. For a moment, I thought I was looking at a series of shaped monoliths embedded in a permanent force field, and then one of the gray things shifted slightly in a stray current of the chilly air, and I suddenly knew what they were.
"Are you impressed, Takashi-san?"
The voice, the elegant Japanese in which I was addressed, hit me like cyanide. My breathing locked up momentarily with the force of my emotions, and I felt a jagged current go through the neurochem system as it responded. I allowed myself to turn toward the voice, slowly. Somewhere under my eye, a muscle twitched with a suppressed will to do violence. "Ray," I said in a manglik. I should have fucking seen this one on the launch pad. Raylene Kawahara stepped from a doorway to one side of the circular chamber where the basilica ended and made an ironic bow. She followed me into a manglik flawlessly.
"Perhaps you should have seen it coming, yes," she mused. "But if there's a single thing that I like about you, Kovach, it is your endless capacity to be surprised. For all your war veteran posturing, you remain at core an innocent. And in these times, that is no mean achievement. How do you do it?"
"Trade secret. You'd have to be a human being to understand it." The insult fell unregarded. Kawahara looked down at the marbled floor as if she could see it lying there.
"Yes, well, I believe we've been over this ground before."
My mind fled back to New Beijing and the cancerous power structures that Kawahara's interests had created there. The discordant screams of the tortured that I had come to associate with her name. I stepped closer to one of the gray envelopes and slapped it. The coarse surface gave under my hand, and the thing swung a little on its cables. Something shifted sluggishly within.
"Bulletproof, right?"
"Mm-hmm."
Kawahara tipped her head to one side.
"Depends on the bullet, I would say. But impact-resistant, certainly."
I manufactured a laugh from somewhere. "Bulletproof womb lining. Only you, Kawahara. Only you would need to bulletproof your clones and then bury them under a mountain." She stepped forward into the light then, and the force of my hate came up and hit me in the pit of the stomach as I looked at her. Raylene Kawahara claimed upbringing among the contaminated slums of Fission City, Western Australia, but if it was true, she had long ago left behind any trace of her origins. The figure opposite me had the poise of a dancer, a balance of body that was subtly attractive without calling forth any immediate hormonal response, and the face above was elfin and intelligent. It was the sleeve she had worn on New Beijing, custom-cultured and untouched by implants of any kind, pure organism, elevated to the level of art. Kawahara had garbed it in black, stiff, tulip-petaled skirts, cupping her lower body to mid-calf, and a soft silk blouse settled over her torso like dark water. The shoes on her feet were modeled on space deck slippers, but with a modest heel, and her auburn hair was short and winged back from the clean, boned face. She looked like the inhabitant of a screen ad for some slightly sexy investment fund.
"Power is habitually buried," she said. "Think of the protectorate bunkers on Harlan's world, or the caverns the envoy corps hid you in while you were made over in their image. The essence of control is to remain hidden from view, is it not?
Judging by the way I've been led around the last week, I'd say yes. Now, do you want to get on with this pitch?
Very well.
Kawahara glanced aside at Trepp, who wandered away into the gloom, neck craned up at the ceiling like a tourist. I looked around for a seat and found none.
You are aware, no doubt, that I recommended you to Lorenz Bancroft.
He mentioned it.
Yes, and had your hotel proved slightly less psychotic, matters would never have got as far out of hand as they have. We could have had this conversation a week ago and saved everyone a lot of unnecessary pain. It was not my intention for Cadman to harm you. His instructions were to bring you here alive.
There's been a change of program, I said, walking along the curve of the end chamber. Cadman's not following his instructions. He tried to kill me this morning. Kawahara made a gesture of irritation.
I know that. That's why you've been brought here.
Did you spring him?
Yes, of course.
He was going to roll over on you?
He told Keith Rutherford that he felt he was not deployed to his best advantage in holding, that it would be hard to honor his contract with me in such a position.
Subtle.
Wasn't it? I never can resist sophisticated negotiation. I felt he earned the reinvestment.
So you beaconed in on me, hooked him out, and beamed him over to Carnage for resleeping, right? I felt in my pockets and found Ortega's cigarettes. In the grim twilight of the Basilica, the familiar pack was like a postcard from another place. No wonder the Panama Rose didn't have his second fighter decanted when we got there. He'd probably only just finished sleeving Cadman. That motherfucker walked out of there in a right-handed god martyr.
About the same time you were coming aboard, Kawahara agreed. In fact, I understand he was posing as a menial, and you walked right past him. I'd rather you didn't smoke in here.
Kawahara, I'd rather you died of an internal hemorrhage, but I don't suppose you'll oblige me. I touched my cigarette to the ignition patch and drew it to life, remembering. The man knelt in the ring. I played it back, slowly. On the deck of the Phytrome ship, peering down at the design being painted onto the killing floor. The upturned face as we passed. Yes, he'd even smiled. I grimaced at the memory.
You're being a lot less courteous than befits a man in your situation.
I thought that underneath the cool I could detect a ragged edge in her voice. Despite her much vaunted self-control, Raylene Kawahara wasn't much better at coping with disrespect than Bancroft, General McIntyre, or any other creature of power I'd had dealings with.
Your life is in danger, and I am in a position to safeguard it.
My life's been in danger before, I told her, usually as a result of some piece of shit like you making large-scale decisions about how reality ought to be run. You've already let Cadman get too close for my comfort. In fact, he probably used your fucking virtual locator to do it.
I sent him, Kawahara gritted, to collect you. Again, he disobeyed me.
Didn't he just? I rubbed reflexively at the bruise on my shoulder. So why should I believe you can do any better next time?
Because you know I can.
Kawahara came across the center of the chamber, ducking her head to avoid the leathery gray clone sacks and intercepting my path around the perimeter. Her face was taut with anger.
I am one of the seven most powerful human beings in this solar system. I have access to powers that the UN Field Commander General would kill for.
This architecture's going to your head, Raylene. You wouldn't even have found me if you hadn't been keeping tabs on Sullivan. How the fuck are you going to find Cadman?
Kovach, Kovach.
There was a definite trembling in her laugh, as if she was fighting off an urge to put her thumbs through my eye sockets.
Do you have any idea what happens on the streets of any given city on Earth if I put out a search for someone? Do you have any idea how easy it would be to snuff you out here and now?
I drew deliberately on the cigarette and plumed the smoke out at her. As your faithful retainer Trepp said not 10 minutes ago, why bring me here just to snuff me out? You want something from me. Now what is it? She breathed in through her nose, hard.
A measure of calm seeped onto her face, and she stepped back a couple of paces, turned away from the confrontation.
"You're right, Kovacs. I want you alive. If you disappear now, Bancroft's going to get the wrong message."
"Or the right message." I scuffed absently at engraved lettering on the stone beneath my feet. "Did you torch him?"
"No."
Kawahara looked almost amused.
"He killed himself."
"Yeah, right."
"Whether you believe it or not is immaterial to me, Kovacs. What I want from you is an end to the investigation. A tidy end."
"And how do you suggest I achieve that?"
"I don't care. Make something up. You're an envoy, after all. Convince him. Tell him you think the police verdict was correct. Produce a culprit if you must."
A thin smile.
"I do not include myself in that category."
"If you didn't kill him, if he torched his own head off, why should you care what happens? What's your interest in this?"
"That isn't under discussion here."
I nodded slowly. "And what do I get in return for this tidy ending?"
"Apart from the $100,000?
Kawahara tilted her head quizzically.
"Well, I understand you've been made a very generous recreational offer by other parties. And for my part, I will keep Cadman off your back by whatever means necessary."
I looked down at the lettering beneath my feet and thought it through, link by link.
"Francisco Franco," Kawahara said, mistaking the direction of my gaze for focused interest. "Petty tyrant a long time back. He built this place."
"Trepp said it belonged to the Catholics."
Kawahara shrugged. "Petty tyrant with delusions of religion. Catholics get on well with tyranny. It's in the culture."
I glanced around, ostensibly casual, scanning for robot security systems. "Yeah, looks like it. So let me get this straight. You want me to sell Bancroft a parabolic full of shit, in return for which you'll call off Cadman, who you set on me in the first place. That's the deal?"
"That, as you put it, is the deal."
I took one last lungful of smoke, savored it, and exhaled. "You can go fuck yourself, Kawahara." I dropped my cigarette on the engraved stonework and ground it out with my heel. "I'll take my chances with Cadman and let Bancroft know you probably had him killed. So, change your mind about letting me live now?" My hands hung open at my sides, twitching to be filled with a rough woven bulk of handgun butts. I was going to put 3 Nemec shells through Kawahara's throat at stack height, then put the gun in my mouth and blow my own stack apart. Kawahara almost certainly had remote storage anyway, but fuck it, you've got to make a stand somewhere, and a man can stave off his own death wish for only so long. It could have been worse. It could have been Inanin. Kawahara shook her head regretfully. She was smiling.
"Always the same, Kovacs. Full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Romantic nihilism. Haven't you learned anything since New Beijing?"
"There are some arenas so corrupt that the only clean acts possible are nihilistic."
"Oh, that's Quell, isn't it? Mine was Shakespeare. But then, I don't expect colonial culture goes back that far, does it?"
She was still smiling, poised like a total body theater gymnast about to launch into her aria. For a moment, I suffered the almost hallucinatory conviction that she was going to break into a little dance, choreographed to a junk rhythm beat from speakers hidden in the dome above us.
"Takashi, where did you get this belief that everything can be resolved with such brute simplicity? Surely not from the envoys. Was it the new pest gangs, the thrashings your father gave you as a child? Did you really think I would allow you to force my hand? Did you really think I would have come to the table this empty-handed? Think about it. You know me. Did you really believe it would be this easy?"
The Norikem settled within me. I bit it back, hung from the moment like a parachutist braced in the jump hatch. "All right," I said evenly. "Impress me."
"Gladly."
Kawahara reached into the breast pocket of her liquid black blouse. She produced a tiny hollow file and flicked it into active with a thumbnail. As the images evolved in the air above the unit, she passed it to me.
A lot of the detail is legalistic, but you will, of course, recognize the salient points.
I took the little sphere of light as if it were a poisonous flower. The name hit me at once, leaping out of the print. Sarah Sakalovska. And then the contract terminology, like a building coming down on me in slow motion. Released into private storage. Provision for virtual custody. Unlimited period. Subject to review at UN discretion. Under vested authority of the Bay City Justice Facility. The knowledge coursed sickly through me. I should have killed Sullivan when I had the chance.
10 days.
Kawahara was watching my reactions closely.
That's how long you have to convince Bancroft the investigation is over and to walk away. After that, Sakalovska goes into virtual at one of my clinics. There's a whole new generation of virtual interrogation software out there, and I will personally see to it that she pioneers the lot.
The holophile hit the marble floor with a brittle crack. I lurched at Kawahara, lips peeling back from my teeth. There was a low growling coming up through my throat that had nothing to do with any combat training I had ever undergone, and the Nemex was forgotten as my hands crooked into talons. I knew what her blood was going to taste like. The cold barrel of a gun touched down on my neck before I got halfway.
"I'd advise against that,"
Trepp said in my ear. Kawahara came and stood closer to me.
"Bancroft isn't the only one who can buy troublesome criminals off colonial stacks. The Kanagawa Justice Facility was overjoyed when I came to them 2 days later with a bid for Sakalovska. The way they see it, if you're DHF'd off-world, the chances of you ever having enough money to buy a needle cast back again are pretty slim. And, of course, they get paid for the privilege of waving you goodbye. It must seem too good to be true. I imagine they're hoping it's the start of a trend."
She fingered the lapel of my jacket thoughtfully.
"And in fact, the way the virtuals market is at the moment, it might be a trend worth starting."
The muscle under my eye jumped violently.
"I'll kill you," I whispered. "I'll rip your fucking heart out and eat it. I'll bring this place down around you."
Kawahara leaned in until our faces were almost touching. Her breath smelled faintly of mint and oregano.
"No, you won't," she said. "You'll do exactly as I say, and you'll do it within 10 days. Because if you don't, your friend Sakalovska will be starting her own private tour of hell without redemption."
She stepped back and lifted her hands.
"Kovach, you should be thanking whatever deities they've got on Harlan's world that I'm not some kind of sadist. I mean, I've given you an either-or. We could just as easily be negotiating exactly how much agony I put Sakalovska through. I mean, I could start now. That would give you an incentive to wrap things up speedily, wouldn't it? 10 days in most virtuals adds up to about 3 or 4 years. You were in the Y clinic. Do you think she could stand 3 years of that? I think she'd probably go insane, don't you?"
The effort it cost me to contain my hate was like a rupture down behind my eyeballs and into my chest. I forced the words out.
"Terms. How do I know you'll release her?"
"Because I give you my word."
Kawahara let her arms fall to her sides.
"I believe you've had some experience of its validity in the past."
I nodded slowly.
"Subsequent to Bancroft's acceptance that the case is closed, and your own disappearance from view, I will DHF Sakalovska back to Harlan's world to complete her sentence."
Kawahara bent to pick up the holophile I'd dropped and held it up.
She tipped it deftly a couple of times to flick through the pages.
"I think you can see here that there is a reversal clause written into the contract. I will, of course, forfeit a large proportion of the original fee paid, but under the circumstances, I'm prepared to do that."
She smiled faintly.
"But please bear in mind that a reversal can work in both directions. When I return, I can always buy again. So if you are considering skulking in the undergrowth for a while, and then running back to Bancroft, please abandon the idea now. This is a hand that you cannot win."
The gun barrel lifted away from my neck, and Trapp stepped back. The Nurachem held me upright like a paraplegic's mobility suit. I stared numbly at Kawahara.
"Why the fuck did you do all this?"
I whispered.
"Why involve me at all if you didn't want Bancroft to find his answers?"
"Because you are an envoy, Kovach."
Kawahara spoke slowly, as if talking to a child.
"Because if anybody can convince Lorenz Bancroft that he died by his own hand, it is you. And because I knew you well enough to predict your moves. I arranged to have you brought to me almost as soon as you arrived, but the hotel intervened. And then, when chance brought you to the Y Clinic, I endeavored to bring you here once again."
"I bluffed my way out of the Y Clinic."
"Oh, yes, your bio-pirate story. You really think you sold them that second-rate Xperia rubbish? Be reasonable, Kovach. You might have backed them up a couple of steps while they thought about it. But the reason, the only reason, you got out of the Y Clinic intact was because I told them to send you that way."
She shrugged.
"But then, you insisted upon escaping. It has been a messy week, and I blame myself as much as anyone else. I feel like a behaviorist who has designed her rat's maze poorly."
"All right."
I noted vaguely that I was trembling.
"I'll do it."
"Yes, of course you will."
I searched for something else to say, but it felt as if I'd been clinically drained of the potential for resistance. The cold of the basilica seemed to be creeping into my bones. I mastered the trembling with an effort and turned to go. Trepp moved silently forward to join me. We had gone about a dozen steps when Kawahara called out behind me.
"Oh, Kovach!"
I turned as if in a dream. She was smiling.
"If you do manage to wrap it up cleanly and very quickly, I might consider some kind of cash incentive. A bonus, so to speak. Negotiable. Trepp will give you a contact number."
I turned away again, numb to a degree I hadn't felt since the smoking ruins of Inanin. Vaguely, I felt Trepp clap me on the shoulder.
"Come on,"
she said companionably.
"Let's get out of here."
I followed her out under the soul-bruising architecture, beneath the sneering smiles of the hooded guardians, and I knew that from among her gray-wombed clones, Kawahara was watching me all the way with a similar smile. It seemed to take forever to leave the hall, and when the huge steel portals cracked open to reveal the outside world, the light that spilled inward was an infusion of life that I grabbed at like a drowning man. All at once, the basilica was a vertical, a cold depth of ocean out of which I was reaching for the sun on the rippled surface. As we left the shadows, my body sucked up the warmth on offer as if it were solid sustenance. Very gradually, the shivering began to leave me. But as I walked away, beneath the brooding power of the cross, I could still feel the presence of the place like a cold hand on the nape of my neck. Chapter 26. That night was a blur. Later, when I tried to get it back, even envoy recall would give me only fragments. Trapp wanted a night on the town. The best nightlife in Europe, she maintained, was only minutes away, and she had all the right addresses. I wanted my thought processes stopped dead in their tracks. We started in a hotel room on a street I could not pronounce.
some tetrameth analog fired through the whites of our eyes by needle spray. I sat passively in a chair by the window and let Trepp shoot me up, trying to not think about Sarah and the room in Millsport. Trying not to think at all. Two-tone holographics outside the window cast Trepp's concentrated features in shades of red and bronze, a demon in the act of sealing the pact. I felt the insidious tilt at the corners of perception as the tetrameth went barreling along my synapses, and when it was my turn to do Trepp, I almost got lost in the geometries of her face. This was very good stuff. There were murals of the Christian hell, flames leaping like clawed fingers over a procession of screaming, naked sinners. At one end of the room, where the figures on the wall seemed to blend with the denizens of the bar in smoke and noise, a girl danced on a rotating platform. A cupped petal of black glass scythed around the platform, and each time it passed between audience and dancer, the girl was gone, and a skeleton danced grinning in her place.
"This place is called All Flesh Will Perish,"
Trepp yelled above the noise as we forced our way in through the crowd. She pointed to the girl and then to the black glass rings on her fingers.
"Where I got the idea for these? Great effect, isn't it?"
I got drinks, quickly. The human race has dreamed of heaven and hell for millennia, pleasure or pain unending, undiminished, and uncurtailed by the strictures of life or death. Thanks to virtual formatting, these fantasies can now exist. All that is needed is an industrial capacity power generator. We have indeed made hell and heaven on Earth.
"Sounds a bit epic, Anjan Chandra's outward-bound valediction to the people sort of thing,"
Trepp shouted.
"But I take your point."
Evidently, the words that had been running through my mind were also running out of my mouth. If it was a quote, I didn't know where it was from. Certainly not a Quellism. She would have slapped anyone making that kind of speech.
"Thing is,"
Trepp was still yelling,
"you've got 10 days.
Reality tilts, flows sideways in gobs of flame-colored light, music, motion, and laughter, the rim of a glass under my teeth, a warm thigh pressed against my own, which I think is Trepp's, but when I turn, another woman with long, straight black hair and crimson lips is grinning at me. Her look of open invitation reminds me vaguely of something I've seen recently. Street scene. Tiered balconies on either side. Tongues of light and sound splashed out onto pavements from the myriad tiny bars. The street itself knotted with people. I walked beside the woman I had killed last week and tried to hold up my end of a conversation about cats. There was something I had forgotten. Something clouded. Something important.
"You can't fucking believe something like that,"
Trepp burst out. Or in. Into my skull at the moment I had almost crystallized what I... Was she doing it deliberately? I couldn't even remember what it was I'd believed so strongly about cats a moment ago. Dancing. Somewhere. More meth. Eye shot in a street corner, leaning against a wall. Someone walked past, called something out to us. I blinked and tried to look.
"Fuck, hold still, will you?"
"What'd she say?" Trepp peeled back my eyelids again, frowning with concentration.
"Called us both beautiful. Fucking junkie. Probably after a handout."
In a wood-paneled toilet somewhere, I stared into a fragmented mirror at the face I was wearing, as if it had committed a crime against me, or as if I was waiting for someone else to emerge from behind the seamed features. My hands were braced on the filthy metal basin below, and the epoxy strips bonding the thing to the wall emitted minute tearing sounds under my weight. I had no idea how long I'd been there. I had no idea where there was, or how many theirs we had already been through tonight. None of this seemed to matter, because the mirror didn't fit its frame. There were pointed jags dug into the plastic edges, holding the star-shaped center precariously in place. "Too many edges," I muttered to myself. "None of this fucking fits together." The words seemed significant, like an accidental rhythm and rhyme in ordinary speech. I didn't think I'd ever be able to repair this mirror. I was going to cut my fingers to shreds just trying. Fuck that. I left Riker's face in the mirror and staggered back out to a table piled high with candles, where Trep was sipping at a long ivory pipe.
Miki Nozawa, are you serious?
Fuck yes, Trip nodded vigorously. The fist of the fleet, right? Seen it 4 times at least. New York Xperia chains get a lot of imported colonial stuff. It's getting to be quite chic. That bit where he takes the harpoonist out with a flying kick. You feel it right down to the bone the way he delivers that fucking kick. Beautiful. Poetry in motion. Hey, you know he did some holoporn stuff when he was younger.
Bullshit. Miki Nozawa never did porn. He didn't need to.
Who said anything about need? The couple of bimbets he was playing around with, I would have played around with them for free.
Bullshit.
I swear to God, that sleeve with the sort of Caucasian nose and eyes, the one he rode off in that cruiser wreck, real early stuff.
There was a bar, where the walls and ceiling were hung with absurd hybrid musical instruments, and the shelves behind the bar were stacked solid with antique bottles, intricately worked statues and other nameless junk. The noise level was comparatively low, and I was drinking something that didn't taste as if it was doing my system too much immediate harm. There was a faint musk in the air and small trays of sweetmeats on the tables. Why the fuck do you do it?
What?
Trep shook her head muzzily.
Keep cats? I like cat.
Work for fucking Kawahara. She's a fucking abortion of a human being, a fucked-up meth cunt not worth the slag of a stack. Why do you... Trep grabbed the arm I was gesturing with, and for a moment I thought there was going to be violence. The neurochem surged soggily. Instead, she took the arm and draped it affectionately over her own shoulders, pulling my face closer to her own. She blinked owlishly at me.
Listen.
There was a longish pause. I listened while Trep frowned with concentration, took a long slug from her glass, and set it down with exaggerated care. She wagged a finger at me.
Judge not, lest ye be judged,
she slurred. Another street, sloping downward. Walking was suddenly easier. Above, the stars were out in force, clearer than I had seen them all week in Bay City. I lurched to a halt at the sight, looking for the horned horse. Something wrong here. Alien. Not a single pattern I recognized. A cold sweat broke along the insides of my arms, and suddenly the clear points of fire seemed like an armada from the outside, massing for a planetary bombardment. The Martians returned. I thought I could see them moving ponderously across the narrow slice of sky above us.
Whoa!
Trep caught me as I fell, laughing.
What are you looking for up there, grasshopper?
Not my sky. It's getting bad. In another toilet, painfully brightly lit, I'm trying to stuff some powder Trep gave me up my nose. My nasal passages are already seared dry, and it keeps falling back down as if this body has definitely had enough. A cubicle flushes behind me, and I glance up into the big mirror. Jimmy DeSoto emerges from the cubicle, combat fatigue smudged with innin' and mud. In the hard bathroom light, his face is looking particularly bad.
All right, pal?
Not especially. I scratch at the inside of my nose, which is beginning to feel inflamed. You? He makes a muss-and-grumble gesture and moves forward in the mirror to stand beside me. Water fountains from the light-sensitive tap as he leans over the basin, and he begins to rinse his hands. Mud and gore dissolve off his skin and form a rich soup, pouring away down the tiny maelstrom of the plug hole. I can sense his bulk at my shoulder, but his one remaining eye has me pinned to the image in the mirror, and I cannot, or don't want to, turn. Is this a dream? He shrugs and goes on scrubbing at his hands.
It's the edge,
he says. The edge of what?
Everything.
His expression suggests that this much is obvious. I thought you only turned up in my dreams, I say, casually glancing at his hands. There is something wrong with them. However much filth Jimmy scrubs off, there's more underneath. The basin is splattered with the stuff.
Well, that's one way of putting it, pal. Dreams, high-stress hallucinations, or just wrecking your own head like this. It's all the edge, see? The cracks down the sides of reality. Where stupid bastards like me end up.
Jimmy, you're dead. I'm getting tired of telling you that.
Uh-uh.
He shakes his head.
But you gotta get right down in those cracks to access me.
The soup of blood and soil in the basin is thinning out. And I know suddenly that when it is gone, Jimmy will be too.
You're saying...
He shakes his head sadly.
Too fucking complicated to go through now. You think we've got the handle on reality just because we can record bits of it? More to it than that, pal. More to it than that.
Jimmy, I make a helpless gesture. What the fuck am I going to do? He steps back from the basin, and his ruined face grins garishly at me.
Viral strike,
he says clearly. I go cold as I remember my own scream taken up along the beachhead.
Recall that mother, do you?
And flicking water from his hands, he vanishes like a conjurer's trick.
Look, Trepp said reasonably, Cadman had to check into the tank to get sleeved in an artificial. I figure that gives you the best part of a day before he even knows if he killed you or not.
If he wasn't already double-sleeved again.
No, think about it. He's cut loose from Kawahara. Man, he doesn't have the resources for that kind of stuff right now. He's fucking out there on his own, and with Kawahara gunning for him, he's a strictly limited item. Cadman's sell-by date is coming up, you'll see.
Kawahara's going to keep him on tap for just as long as she needs him to drive me.
Yeah, well...
Trepp looked at her drink, embarrassed.
Maybe.
There was another place, called Cable, or something synonymous, where the walls were racked with color-coded conduits, out of whose designer cracked casings, wires sprouted like stiff copper hair. At intervals along the bar were hooks draped with thin, lethal-looking cables that ended in gleaming silver mini-jacks. In the air above the bar, a huge holographic jack and socket fucked spasmodically to the offbeat music that filled the place like water. At times, the components seemed to change into sex organs. But that could have been tetrameth-induced hallucination on my part. I was sitting at the bar, something sweet smoldering in an ashtray at my elbow. From the sludgy feeling in my lungs and throat, I'd been smoking it. The bar was crowded, but I suffered the strange conviction I was alone. On either side of me, the other customers at the bar were jacked into the thin cables, eyes flickering beneath lids that seemed bruised, mouths twitched into dreamy half-smiles. One of them was Trepp. I was alone. Things that might have been thoughts were tugging at the abraded underside of my mind. I picked up the sweetly smoldering cigarette and drew on it grimly. Now was no time for thinking. No time for viral strike. Thinking. Streets passing beneath my feet the way the rubble of Inanin passed under Jimmy's boots as he walked along beside me in my dreams. So that's how he does it. The crimson-lipped woman who... Maybe you can't.
What? What?
Jack and Socket.
Trying to tell you some...
No time for... No time. Nope. And away, like water in the maelstrom. Like the soup of mud and gore pouring off Jimmy's hands and into the hole at the bottom of the sink. Gone again. But thought, like the dawn, was inevitable. And it found me, with the dawn, on a set of white stone steps that led down into murky water. Grandiose architecture reared vaguely behind us, and on the far side of the water I could make out trees in the rapidly graying darkness. We were in a park. Trepp leaned over my shoulder and offered me a lit cigarette. I took it reflexively, drew once,
and then let smoke dribble up through my slack lips. Trep settled into a crouch next to me. An unfeasibly large fish flopped in the water at my feet. I was too